Welcome to the Inclusive Social Media Evaluation Webinar Teleconference Exchange on May 16, 2012, hosted by eDemocracy.org. This is Stephen Clift. I'm the Executive Director and founder of eDemocracy. And I'm joined with Ann Carroll, who was the lead on an evaluation project that we put together for eDemocracy. And I'm going to turn this over to Ann very quickly, but before I do that, let me just mention that in addition to Ann assisting us on the evaluation, Ann is also a member of the board for eDemocracy.org, a longtime member, and I'll let her introduce herself with a little more detail. And also Julia Patti is on the audio side of our event, and she has been active with part of our outreach team, and you'll see her referred to today. We also have Corinne Bruning, who is newer to eDemocracy. She's been with us for about a year, and Corinne is our outreach coordinator, and at some point we'll mention some of our current outreach efforts that Corinne is helping lead, particularly in St. Paul. We also have Ed Davis, who provides technical and participant support for eDemocracy with us today. And he also does a lot of tabling for our outreach. And Tim Erickson, who's also assisting us with training and basically user support educational materials. And for those of you who know eDemocracy from yesteryear, Tim was heavily involved for a decade and has taken a break, and now it's back with us. So we have a good team of folks that are tuned in today, and we look forward to engaging with you here. I see that one person has had trouble has some elevator music or audio. So if anyone has had issues with the audio but are on the web chat and have figured out how to break through, just let me know if you've also had any troubles getting in. I'm trying to figure out where Michael Dilio is with their system. So
I've just sent him a note.
Okay, great. All right, so... all right, Ann, why don't you take it away?
Although I'm going to make you talk again, Steve, right at this next slide.
That's great.
So thanks so much, everybody, for being here. We're going to go through a process that is very participatory and still leave lots of room at the end. But Steve introduced himself and co-presenters. Participants, we're going to ask you to introduce yourself as you ask your questions. The structure we're going to use is to go through a series of slides that are available up on the Eventbrite location where you registered, and we're going to encourage you to type your questions into the chat line that's at the bottom of the webinar slide. You should see it at the bottom of yours. Steve's going to keep track of them, and then at several points in the presentation, we're going to take a formal pause and pile on a bunch of questions, and then I hope leave a lot of room at the end of the discussion to be completely open about it. So let me proceed quickly. And Steve, if you want to just go through as the founder to talk a little bit about this slide.
Sure. So for those of you who are new to eDemocracy or just heard about us or haven't tuned in for a while, we actually have our start back in 1994 with the world's first election information website. And the heart of what we did that lasted past that election was the online commons, creating a public space in the heart of democracy and community that kind of allowed people to have a voice. We brought that model local in 98. Going forward, we now primarily host local issues forums or local neighbors forums. We have over 50 of them, some of them very active, some of them really in the startup mode or not as active as we would like, but they cover 17 different communities, mostly in Minnesota, but also four communities in the UK, Christchurch region in New Zealand, and then a few other startup efforts like Eau Claire, Wisconsin, and others. We also have a strong mission around lesson sharing and promoting civic engagement online globally. For those of you who know me through my Democracy's Online Newswire hat, I used to sort of some of those types of things we're slowly but surely bringing into the online communities of practice that we host via eDemocracy rather than being a separate piece. And we publish a lot of things that we've discovered along the way as a 501c3 nonprofit. And our major initiatives in the last couple of years have been the inclusive social media work that was funded by the Ford Foundation, which we're going to hear about really in depth, year one, 2010, bid on 2011, and then now 2012 through 2014, we have launched a major initiative called Inclusive Community Engagement Online with funding from the Knight Foundation. That is actually a $625,000 three-year project, significant funding. And part of that actually is going to be dedicated to lesson sharing beyond the really intensive work in St. Paul. And lesson sharing meaning trying to engage other Knight communities and other communities that are interested in adapting these lessons. So in some ways, today is a chance for us to test out this webinar format as a way to fulfill that mission. And even though it's the end of the Forward project, in some ways it's also the beginning of a greater lesson sharing with Knight. So, all right, Anne, go ahead.
Great. Thank you so much. So I'm going to start with the process and then talk about outcomes and break after each. So for this effort, which is we're talking just about essentially 2010's work that we evaluated that was forward funded. So what we have seen in our 20 years of experience and all kinds of information from around the world is that online exchanges have done a really good job at concentrating power and influence in the hands of the few. You know who we are, and we also have seen open government trends. Great idea, very democratic concept, but again, they are empowering the people who are often already empowered rather than spreading the base farther. So what we see with the existing efforts around Yahoo groups, Facebook groups, various blogs and emails, we see a lot of youth in wealthier, more homogenous parts of communities. And fundamentally, from a democracy standpoint, we looked at this and said, you know, this isn't working to bring an inclusive approach, to bring inclusive solutions, and we're not tapping into that capacity of neighbors to help neighbors. So we looked at our own mission statement, our own strategic plan, as well as some initial efforts that we had begun and decided to take this on as a really serious task. So our commitment, our objectives, were to demonstrate, not just talk about, but actually demonstrate that we can do this on a neighborhood basis and that they can and should work in high immigrant, low income, racially and ethnically diverse neighborhoods. We also thought it was really important to figure out what's working, what isn't working, and why. Then not just sit on our own laurels, but instead serve as a platform to help others and do what we can to expand. Those were the objectives of this board-funded initiative. So we specifically targeted the kinds of neighborhoods that are least likely to have local community-building efforts that use social media. So the focus was on those particular communities.
And if I could just interrupt one quick second.
Go ahead, Steve, please.
For some folks who have joined us, and perhaps they're driving or have some background noise, if you could mute your local phone, that would be great. Thank you.
Thank you, Steve. And as we mentioned at the beginning, Julia, you're online also, and we're central to this work. So I hope that you have a chance to pop in and make some comments, certainly any time in the process you want, but also in the outcomes. So eDemocracy secured Ford Foundation funding for this 2010 pilot in two neighborhoods, one in Minneapolis, Minnesota in the U.S. and the other in St. Paul, Minnesota. They are rivalrous siblings right across the river from each other. The downtowns are about 10 miles apart, but they abut each other. But they're quite different communities. These two neighborhoods that we selected are very high immigrant, high poverty, and high people of color. So we explicitly went about targeting in-person relationships. As you, those of you who had a chance to read the evaluation saw, it was exceptionally successful, and it was the only way that we were successful in targeting members, people to sign up to become members of these neighborhood-based forums. You see a couple of photos here of community events, going, you know, walking through the neighborhoods, going business to business, going area to area, using paper signups to have those face-to-face connections in those beginnings of those relationships, and to let people know this was real people doing real things, not some anonymous, scary place, and difficult and risky. We were trying to reduce the risk by building the person-to-person and face-to-face relationships. Julia, do you want to chat about that at all? Are you there? Go ahead.
Here.
Go ahead.
Yes, some of the inclusion in the building friendships with community leaders and people who are sort of gatekeepers of information, people who had access to the internet already and were able to use the forum to sort of use the information from the forum and share with people. So part of that was building relationships with these people and with local businesses and just making a presence of the forum known to them.
Thank you. And helping, also I remember you talking a lot about helping people see its relevance to them.
Yes, that was another key issue because especially if you look at community advocates and people who already work in the community, it was important to add value for them so that they don't see that this is an extra step for them to do in their already, you know, they're already overworked, they're already doing so much more. And so this was, it was important to show them that this was just an extra, it was an extra step, but it was useful. They had access to politicians, other community advocates. They had even to institutions. For example, Cedar Riverside, where I worked, is very close to about three or four large institutions, including the University of Minnesota. And so it was, yeah, it was important for that to be like a conduit for all these different interests to see that this was something that they could continue to use. And some local politicians are also on the forum. And I know Frogtown had the same sort of, that was Bolly's also. She had the same sort of experience where she had to keep selling the value of the forum to this community advocate.
Absolutely. And it did, it wasn't something with individuals. I think there was better success getting them engaged and generally helping them, finding ways to have them stay. There was more work often to get people, organizations and elected officials, we'll talk about this a little bit more in a minute, to kind of continually support and continually nudge them to stay involved.
Right, and that was part of actually, I don't know if you're going to cover this later, but this is what was part of the challenge was to get. Hello?
Yes,
yes.
Go ahead.
Yeah, this was part of. Can you hear me?
Yes.
This was part of the challenge was to keep them interested long term and to see that yes, you have one event this month, but next month keep coming, and so that's part of the relationship building that I think. For such small communities that you have to continuously have this relationship. It has to be long term. You can't just go there once and expect that they'll develop trust or see this as a safe space for them to interact.
That's a really good point. So these are three of the major outcomes we evaluated in this particular set of work for the 2010 effort. So looking at outreach and information leadership development structures and techniques, specific ways to increase the forum size, diversity, energy, and community building potential, and how to engage all kinds of different groups from organizers
this
to organizations
is now ending.
And elected officials. So we're looking at the full gamut there. Let me do this last slide before we break for questions about the process. The methods that we used in this particular participatory evaluation, working through Julia and Bali and Marnie Zhang and several other people, we did this interview-based, as well as, you know, with lots of forum participants, the outreach staff themselves, our volunteer forum managers, talking to community activists, elected officials, and others who were on the two forums. So tons and tons of interviews. Then we did some hard analyses, some quantitative analyses of neighborhood demographics as well as poster and forum activity and post content. So the two combined into a very rich and I think very thoughtful opportunity to hear through other people's voices what they experienced. So let me take a break at this moment and let's do some questions about the process. Steve, do you have any queued up?
All right, Ann. Yeah, so I haven't seen any questions come in on the chat so far, so would love to have people, if they have any questions about the evaluation process, to chime in now. I can add a quick comment and say that, you know, for our organization, having sort of scraped by Lean and Mean for years, this was a very different experience for us to sort of step back and be, I guess, 10 times more deliberate about, you know, so what is it that we want to measure that matters most? And part of the process also was two quick comments. One was in the past, because, you know, everything was volunteer-based and subsidized by my volunteer time and Tim's volunteer time and a few small grants, really, we sort of felt it was a miracle that anything happened at all, right? That any neighborhood or any community had an online town hall. Really, in our past with the more political citywide spaces, you know, we didn't see people creating citywide discussions. There were some blogs. Yes, newspapers had commenting, but the model that we had was pretty rare. But now at the neighborhood level and with funding and with a funder that actually, you know, where social justice is one of the core things that Ford talks about, you know, suddenly it's a whole different game in a sense. It's like, you know, if you're going to justify the actual investment of grant dollars, what is the social benefit being created? And so a lot of that sort of challenge with funding was, let's really dig deep, and it's more than just is it open or not, or are people posting or not, and so that's one of my comments. So, so I see Ed actually has a question that he put in here about Ed. Why don't you say it? Because I don't quite understand it.
I was just wondering if the participants who were or discussions involved about the forum thought that email-based listserv was an easy way for them to participate in any discussions? Or was there other... Well, that's basically the online tool question in terms of was that online tool effective for them to participate?
So I think that's, if I'm correct, not to stop you, but I think part of it is that we're looking at questions about the process in terms of the evaluation, and then that question will be a great question to bring up in terms of the next set. So I see a couple of questions that have come in here on the chat. Deborah has a question about needing to develop in-person relationships, and the question is about the online component, what it was and how did it work, where do people go to participate. Anne, do you want to take that one?
Sure. These are online forums. So you would go to people go to the edemocracy.org website and pick a forum that's in their neighborhood, although people aren't restricted in their membership to each forum, but the content of each forum is restricted to issues, topics, announcements, news that has to do with that particular neighborhood. So they go to the edemocracy.org website, which is the information that's provided to people when they sign up, and then they just start posting and being part of this listserv-type exchange. The key issue, of course, is that with our edemocracy forums, there is a volunteer forum manager, and all members of any forum adhere to the same civility rules and limit of 2 posts per 24-hour period. There's a question earlier, too, that I thought was interesting about the notion of door knocking. One of the things that did come up in the evaluation was the notion of the power of traditional community organizing techniques that are quite common in the U.S., and those are also very similar to political organizing techniques, and door knocking is one of those. So we see door knocking as a very popular activity in many situations, well beyond community organizing and politics. And I think in a number of neighborhoods, that kind of approach would work very, very well. In the one of the issues in Cedar Riverside, which is one of our neighborhoods in our evaluation process, it is dominated by a half dozen very high-rise rental units, rental properties. So you have an intense concentration of many, many hundreds of people, but there isn't free access. Now, of course, people who live in the high-rises have free access, but it's a little bit different as a political organizing or a community organizing structure. If you're in a neighborhood that has a lot
free
of
free access meaning not online access, but free. You can't just go. You can't just walk on those buildings and talk to the 3,000 people that live there.
Right.
they're secure. Yep.
But people who are members of the forums and who live in those buildings can do so. And so we certainly saw some of that on a face-to-face basis, and you can do that in many neighborhoods. We also tried to look at situations where people were concentrated, people who were interested and engaged in community activities but weren't necessarily the organizers thereof. They were more participants. We found that to that kind of density and 100% access, right? They're all there. You can get to them was very efficient.
One thing I could add. Okay, Julia.
So in terms of especially the high-rise, one of the challenges also that I saw there, which again speaks to the developing long-term relationship, is that for these neighborhoods, particularly and Frogtown, that have a high, you know, if you don't knock in during political season, if whenever there's some sort of
Julia, you're breaking up on us here, so we lost you.
Yes. Large corporations who go in to sell something, sell an idea, or disseminate information, or to get people information from people. So Cedar Riverside is highly immigrant populated, most Somali, and so the University of Minnesota and there. So one of the feedback that I was getting are the challenges people felt that, well, people are always coming here to do something. They're always coming here to take something from us. So part of that relationship building was saying, well, not really. We're not taking anything from you. We're actually giving you a tool to talk about some of these issues. This is not us wanting something from you. And I think that was the unique position that e-democracy was and continues to be. It's not...
So one thing I'd like to So, Julia, you've been cutting up a bit, so if you just could try and position yourself near a window, that would be great for the next comment. One thing I'd like to add, because there's a question about – so some fundamental sort of background question about, like, where do you go? So basically every one of our forums has a homepage. You can find it from the homepage on eDemocracy. We assign a link to it that people can type in, and we use email newsletters and other ways of promoting that link. People sign up like a Yahoo group or a Google group, you know, it basically you get email unless you turn it off. We find it's very sticky, if you will, in bridge building. There are those who hate email, and so therefore you can turn it off completely. We also feed the forums into Facebook pages. We also feed the subject lines into Twitter. And so our sort of approach is with these neighbors forums is how do you reach people where they are? So that's been really key to us. The other question is sort of like what the heck is a neighbors forum? What's its purpose? And so we have a dual purpose. One is to unleash sort of community exchange. So in some of our forums, particularly where people are homeowners, there's a lot of discussions about who can recommend a good plumber, a lot of discussions about crime, discussions about local neighborhood activities. Some are quite chatty and social, people sharing plants, people connecting for play dates. In other places, they're more political, and I think we can talk more about that, where there's more of a discussion about light rail or different types of issues. But the fundamental goal is a many-to-many space among neighbors over the back fence or over coffee and of sorts. So I hope that helps give a quick background there. So I see some more questions coming in, Anne. Do you want to grab one or two of those before moving on?
Well, some of them seem to be related to outcomes, so I'm wondering if we should just move on to that.
Great. Why don't you pile into that and then maybe address these along the way.
Yep. Why don't I do that? So let's get at some of these outcome questions. First outcome that we were measuring had to do with developing outreach and information leadership development structures and techniques. So we talked earlier about email, face-to-face, personal outreach was what made this work. Julia and others have talked about trust, hugely significant, working through individuals. This is common in any community. I don't want to suggest that lots of this is unique to high immigrant, high poverty people of color, because it's not. It is a very cross-cultural issue that if someone you know or someone who you meet is involved with something, your sense of trust is substantially higher than if you just bump into it by yourself, and particularly if you bump onto it electronically. So the trust piece was overwhelmingly important. The other dimension of this that is more of a cultural linguistic issue is the sense of knowing that someone like me is on the forum. So, again, that ability of someone like you, whatever that is, inviting you, making you aware of this, telling you about the online forums, we found was incredibly valuable in terms of a mechanism to get people to sign up. And when that happened, of course, then you have a friend on the forum, you have someone you know, and then you meet other people on the forums, and your comfort level increases and you're more likely to stay. So those kinds of personal invitations and support. One of the things that we did that was incredibly valuable on the Frogtown forum, and we weren't trying to say we'll do it on one forum and not do it on the other, it was just was how it happened. People seeded conversations, which means that Bali in particular and the Frogtown Forum, who was an eDemocracy staff member, just a few hours a week, a very few hours a week, would start conversations. Did you hear about this? Who knows something about that? There's this event coming up. There's this happening. What do you think? So not just announcements, but asking questions to stimulate conversations. And as those of you have a chance to read the report will see, it was enormously significant. It kept conversation going, and it created depth that sometimes has trouble getting started otherwise. And as Julia mentioned earlier, partnering with organizations who would then tell their members, their participants, et cetera, about the forum was really important. We learned that cultural awareness and language skills are very, very important. Our online forums at the moment are 99.99% in English. However, if you're in a high immigrant neighborhood, being able to have conversations in a person's native language, which had to do with our outreach staff, even if forum participation is in English, those personal relationships or personal connections in a home language are enormously important with regard to building trust and also being aware of cultural, racial, gender issues that need to be addressed. We'll talk about
to add there. In both Cedar Riverside in particular, we had a number of health-related announcements from organizations, particularly when H1N1 was out, that were both sent out in English, Somali, and Spanish. And we've had also examples in Powderhorn, which is not part of the study, but where there's a large Spanish-speaking population where really community gardening groups and others with dual language newsletters would use the forum. We have had one conversation that was in Somali. We've also had Somali, like a local Somali music video that was produced by someone that was shared via the forum. And we basically have said to folks, there is no official language on the forum, but we do ask for assistance in monitoring that a fight doesn't break out in a language that our forum manager can't understand. So we've asked the Somali gentleman to basically say, if there are discussions in Somali, just let us know if there are issues related to civility that emerge that we should be aware of. But obviously it's very, very rare at this point.
Great, thank you. And Steve, if you'll keep monitoring the questions down there, that would be really helpful. I'm having trouble doing that at the same time. So,
yep.
And others too. I see that we've got staff people who are weighing in, and that's really helpful. Thank you. So the last piece related to this outcome that was a finding is that it was important to build and support participation through an active and diverse forum base. So it can't be just about the volunteer forum manager and or eDemocracy throwing money at staff people for a few hours a week. Where this takes off in any situation, which is sort of common sense, but it was important to document, is when you have a diverse in all ways, diverse perspectives, diverse people, diverse posts, a wide variety, you get the kind of capacity within the forum to make these self-sustaining over time. Now, one of the differences, of course, is when you have a bunch of fairly homogenous, native English-speaking, financially comfortable, relatively well-educated, a lot of computer access and a lot of comfort in computer use for these email-based conversations, the ability to build that capacity and to sustain it happens much more quickly. We see it happening in these forums, which are our targets, our focus areas. It just took more time, and it took more care, and it took more work at the beginning for them to become self-sustaining. Let me go on to the other outcomes.
And when would be a good time to talk about digital divide?
Well, do you want to do that right now? Because
why don't
it comes
we?
In, you know, forum size, diversity, energy, and community building potential. Go ahead.
We have two questions about that. One is Bruce has asked a question about computer literacy and basic computer skills, and then the other question about broadband access and the like. So really, really important. So one of the key things about Cedar Riverside in particular was that we were right next to the Brian Coyle Community Center, which has an open access computer lab. We, in fact, donated a couple of digital cameras and a flip cam as an attempt to sort of build our relationship there to sort of encourage content purely from youth programming to get posted out into the forum. And I believe some photos were shared once that the loop wasn't closed as much as we had liked. But in general, we found that there were key examples of where conversations, particularly after a triple homicide in the neighborhood next door involving East African community directly, you know, the conversation on the forum then became the conversation among the youth about access to weapons and the need to arm yourself to protect yourself against others versus trusting the police. And so the conversation flowed from the forum right into the computer room and had a discussion with youth workers, right? So there was that, you know, interesting connection there. In general, we found that the Somali community is relatively well-wired. I would say that we had more issues with the Hmong community, particularly the obviously older Hmong community in Frogtown, and there was examples of where we tabled where our outreach person said, I was there for hours and I only signed up 8 people because most people didn't have access to the Internet. And
Steve,
so,
Steve,
you know,
explain what tabling means.
Tabling, yes. Setting up a table with flyers and posters saying, you know, meet your neighbors online, connect, have a voice. In Frogtown, we had big posters in Hmong, which is Hmong is a group primarily from the mountains of Laos. We have tens of thousands of Hmong settled into the East Metro region in particular.
We have the largest population of Hmong people in the world.
Yeah.
In Saipan.
So it's there we go. And so one of the things we found is that what we're doing is sort of like built on the foundation of broadband access or consumer access. Then you have the issue of like computer skills and the digital media skills, right? And so it's like there's this pyramid of sorts. And if it wasn't for the fact that there were activities happening in our communities to provide access to the libraries, to encourage people to learn how to use email or be able to use different programming. And what we've noticed is every year that we've worked with, like it's a project called CTEP, which is an AmeriCorps project in town that works in a lot of computer access telecenters. You know, we talk to them once a year, meet their youth, you know, promote the forums via them. Every year they've been doing more and more sort of digital media work where communities are sort of going up this pyramid. And so clearly without that, it would be difficult to really, if that wasn't happening in our community, this would not connect as well at all. But we also pragmatically have found that there are what we call them bridges in households, but the folks at the table who do use the Internet, it might be a younger person in particular, maybe we can talk more about that later. But
yep.
Go ahead, back to you, Ann.
No, thank you, Steve, because that's really important. And an interesting dimension, right? Many of us, when we look at this work, we don't just look at what worked. We looked at what didn't work. And I will say that, and you'll see a little bit more about this later, is when we were looking at high poverty, high immigrant, high people of color, you notice that we weren't targeting elders and we weren't targeting children, young children. And it wasn't on purpose. We just targeted what we targeted because it aligned with our mission and Ford's mission and so on. And so we don't have answers to people who aren't computer literate, because this is by definition an online forum. As some of the text chatting is indicating, some literacy classes, we have done some on computer literacy, but we are fundamentally this is for people who do have access in some form. I will say that I also serve as an elected official here in St. Paul, and I serve on the Board of Education, where we've got 75% poverty in our kids and families. And we have in the 90s in terms of daily access to internet. In the 90s, you know, over 90% of our families have daily access to internet. So access is much less of an issue than a number of things. And again, note the heavy emphasis on straight up, simple, low barrier email. And so, as many of the posts show, this isn't about sophistication or necessarily super strong English skills. It's about creating opportunities where people feel comfortable participating on a neighborhood level. So what we saw in terms of this outcome number two, is significant growth in 2010 and even more since. One of the things we looked at is proportion of posts to authors, because when you look at diversity, you look at, do we have, even though there's a 2-post-per-day limit, do we have, you know, a few posters making almost all the posts? And both forums showed a lot of diversity of new authors and posts, which is good, which you want to see. Sometimes when forums start, and even sometimes as they mature, if they get narrow, you have you know, the same 15 or 20 people doing the majority of the posts. We were not seeing that in either of those forums, and that was an important measure for us. We did see in Cedar Riverside more active participation by new immigrants. That, I'm sure, has a lot to do with the underlying demographics that are there. In Frogtown, one of the interesting things we looked at was people who post versus people who start threads. So starting a thread is a multi-post subject line. So we looked at how many responses to a particular subject line we got. And there was, in Cedar Riverside, there was more domination of thread starters by certain people, but then lots of people participated. In Frogtown, if you take out the seeding that was done that's referenced in the last bullet here that our staff member Bali did, if you take those out, which is, of course, you have to because those were, you know, we did that, we saw a lot of balance between the number of people and the particular individuals who started threads, who started subjects, and the posters. Starting threads is perceived as a somewhat risky endeavor. Okay. Because it's like, do you start it and then nobody participates? Or you're creating a conversation. So the first person to talk on that topic, it's a scarier proposition. So it's one of the measures we looked at is how did we do with regard to people starting threads.
Thing to add. Tom asked about this 2-post-a-day limit, and it kind of fits with this dominating discussion. So uniquely, since kind of like how Twitter limits you to the number of characters. Since 94, for whatever reason, we decided to limit people to roughly 2 posts a day. I mean, sometimes our forums are 3 a day, and we do this now technologically, and the whole idea is sort of like a talking stick in a group. And how this relates specifically to Cedar Riverside is that we had a participant, a Somali male, who was very active on the forum and often very aggressive in his communication. And if you dig into the report,
it was interpreted as such. Yep.
That's right. I mean, that's right. I mean, he was very active and very activist, and sometimes that was very, very good. Other times, you know, people were like, "Well, why is he always, you know, advocating?" And the issue it's a, you know, the nuances also related to, not nuances, but some of the issues related to tensions between and gender in terms of people's style and things happening privately. Without that 2-post-a-day limit, that person's posting volume may have just gone out the roof, and also the amount of conflict that can emerge very quickly between just two people. And if it's kind of like going to a restaurant, right? If it's generally, if it, you go 10 times and it's pretty good, you like it, and you go once and it's a, you have a bad experience. And so these forums in general are always just one bad experience from like losing everyone's trust. And so we've generally found that slowing down the volume of exchange is one of the only ways to then ensure that volunteers that we have, which is key to keeping the cost down, can monitor stuff and to actually leave it unmoderated and not have it go out of hand. Otherwise, the alternative is to moderate everything, which is more labor-intensive, which volunteers won't do, and so on and so forth. So that's a key
thing. Explain what you mean by moderating.
And by moderating, we mean, in our case, reviewing a message before it is sent out. There, and on web-based systems, you hear about post-moderation, where someone does something and it's naughty, and then you take it off afterwards. But because at least 2/3 of our users stay with the email, getting one email at a time, the damage is done instantly if people, you know, go off the handle quickly. And it could happen in an hour, and our volunteer might not notice that something has happened, and to either intervene publicly by saying, hey, calm down. So that's how we use moderation. It's pre-moderation, and it's very, very limited to new users.
Right. So once a forum is rolling and people are online working, there is no moderation. It is a free flow of information. Mm-hmm. Someone asked about the difference between sort of an information exchange and our forums. There is a lot of information that is exchanged, but the notion is to have discussions. So that's where you, again, you'll see in the evaluation report where you have, we measured how much response was there to threats. So in an information exchange, there's like somebody posts something and somebody posts something else, and they are independent of each other, and typically, except perhaps for clarifying questions, nothing comes from it. These are specifically intended for to begin conversations. Did Julia, were you jumping in to say something, or did I hear someone?
Oh, no, that wasn't me.
Okay. So it's a different concept. And someone also asked about sort of social media. Even though this is broadly classified under social media, it actually doesn't feel like other social media at all. And most people who are members and participants don't treat it like social media. And part of that is also because what people understand when they join, or what they are told when they join, is that, you know, with the exception of one in a million, all your posts exist forever and are searchable online. So those of us who've been active in this for a long time, when we every once in a while check our own, do a Google search on ourselves to make sure that, you know, something awful hasn't been said or done, the highest percentage of hits come from eDemocracy forum posts. So people are more thoughtful and more careful in these posts, and people realize that it's going to many hundreds, if not thousands, of people. That's part of the trust piece, and that's part of the support and seeding that builds forums in cases like the communities in which we're working here, because it's scarier if you really think about it. Let's go on a little bit more, talk about somebody was talking about, again, how is it related to information exchange. What we see is the power of cross-pollinating. Between what's happening in the community. Julia, you certainly did a lot of this. Bao did a lot of this in Frogtown, and many, many community members did this. They said, here this is happening. Are you going? What do you think about this? How is this going to affect our neighborhood? So making it relevant, grounding it, making sure there's some connection with what's happening in the community. Otherwise, you know, why would people participate in this? A couple of challenges we found in these, both these forums. The whole cultural competency piece. Awareness that there were a wide variety of different people on these forums who looked at the world differently and who responded to posts and information and perceptions and ideas differently. So Steve talked earlier about the person who whose posts were very aggressive. And I don't believe that he intended them to sound like shouting. And English is not his first language. And so how do we factor those in to how forums are managed and how people feel about it? As you'll see in the full report, there were some very complex gender issues with women, again, on the Cedar Riverside East African community, in the Cedar Riverside Forum, posting and getting chewed out by men in their neighborhoods who had seen or heard about the posts. And we had Julie worked extremely hard to help create this as a safe space and support women. You know, and this wasn't like widespread, but there were a number. And when you start these things, you just need to be aware of and sensitive to and listen for and ask about and assume that you don't know and to pay attention to this. Any time you add the amount of heterogeneity that we do in these forums, it dramatically increases the complexity. It also dramatically increases the value and the impact at a community level to build those connections and build those bridges. But you can't just blindly go into it and say, "Hey, this is it's all the same. It doesn't matter. It's not a big deal," because it does. The other challenge we found was engaging businesses and institutions. We had a very tough time finding ways for businesses and institutions to find forum participation relevant to them. Steve and Julia, can one of you talk about a couple of exceptions to that?
Well, one thing I could add, in Frogtown, for example, the Alliance for Metropolitan Stability has very effectively used the forum to share announcements about their organizing events. So they're out organizing folks, and they found that it's a good way to get folks to an event. In Frogtown, a community effort out of the blue to basically start an urban farm called Frogtown Farm, you know, they've just agreed to a multi-million-dollar sort of discounted price on a facility in the middle of this very urban neighborhood to build an urban farm. And it started in part by posting to the forum and getting 30 people, and they figure that two-thirds of the folks in that room came because of the forum. Now, they went offline and did their own thing for 2 years of hard work, but the forum allowed that to happen and it get more bodies in the room early. And so those are key. But we found also that with, like, cultural organizations, like I had this goal that the Hmong Cultural Center, which has a library on University Avenue in Frogtown, would begin to cross-post their events. And a lot of these groups barely have websites, maybe haven't, you know, basically they have a Word document that they've printed and put on bulletin boards in many cases. Some may have experimented with Facebook pages, but many folks, you know, the idea was, you know, to try to get them to attach the flyer that went on the bulletin board to an email. And in some cases it worked. Around Brian Coyle it did. We saw things coming more from, like, the Brian Coyle Center at times. But it definitely did not happen at the rate that I had wanted to see from smaller organizations.
And can you talk a little bit about the Wellna Hardware?
Yes. So this is an example. So this is an example where I sort of played this. Yeah, where I played a forum engagement role. So, like, you know, so this is, you know, in cases we have, you know, a typical forum, we don't have any paid staff. We have a forum manager who's a volunteer who will at times seed topics, look for announcements, and the more active forums have that volunteer is more active. Other forums, the volunteer is more of a sort of they're there in case there's a problem. We try to encourage more activity. Sometimes I model that behavior and do it in different ways. And so one example was there was a discussion about a huge snowstorm hit. It was the biggest one in 20 years, but, you know, the Somali community in particular in these towers hadn't been there for 20 years, maybe 10 years, right, and or more. But the key was that they felt, some people on the forum, like, oh, my gosh, the town has left us behind. No one's plowing us out. There's 3,000 of us stuck here. Our elders are slipping on, you know, on the ice. They can't get food. I mean, it's just terrible. And, you know, by posting about it, people came to realize from others that this was a big deal, that the storm was hitting everybody. They weren't uniquely being left behind. Everybody was buried. But we had that conversation about, you know, shoe wear and sandals and lack of boots and hats and mittens and different things. And so I basically said, well, maybe we could have a little winter wear drive. And Wellna Hardware, which is a hardware store just in the neighborhood next door, but just, you know, 5 minutes walk away, basically said, hey, we'd be willing to be a drop site. The Residents Association at the biggest high-rise tower said, hey, we'll be a drop site, and we'll help distribute these to families that need them. And over, I believe, it was like 60 different sort of donations in a few days were given via Wellna Hardware. So in this case, a sort of a solution came. Now, I took the initiative to sort of try to orient the conversation toward a solution or something people could do, an action, rather than just, you know, a discussion about the problem. And I think that's, you know, you have to be careful and not do that the wrong way or do it too often. But in this case, it did help facilitate organic action by other parties.
Perception over there. So, did you talk about the farmer's market?
The farmer's market? Steve, do you want to talk about the farmer's market? Because Julie
Julie, give it a try to see if you can.
Okay, let me talk. So what happened was.
There's someone who's typing right now. If you could put your phone on mute, that'd be great. Go ahead, Julia.
Go ahead, Steve. Why don't you talk about it? I think we may have lost Julia for now.
So the key thing there in the farmers market case was that the there's a farmers market that Augsburg College, which is also part of that neighborhood, helped put together at Augsburg and right in the center of this housing complex near Brian Coyle Community Center. And they were having a hard time getting folks to show up. And while we got him to start posting about it on the forum, you know, what really happened that really secured it was that when he came and visited Julia, Julia walked him around and introduced him to people. And the word of the mouth trust that was built from that led to more people showing up. And, you know, and although he continued to use the forum, though, with recipes each week and sort of sharing some photos of produce, it was an interesting case where because we had field staff, you know, there and were sort of playing an information mediator role, sort of a new opportunity emerged for us. And so Julie took the initiative to sort of, you know, add value to that. And so when posts then came through from him, he was more known to the folks that had the ability to, and the trust in the community to spread the word, right, so that the oral connections were increased. And I believe there was part of the conversation also was that, you know, there's just some fundamental, you know, need to explain what some of these vegetables were and how they might relate to, you know, say, an East African diet or be integrated. And I think they tried to follow up on that as well.
And
thank you.
Again, just a little bit of detail that one of the
So Julia, you're just not coming through strongly enough. So if you are able to switch phones or come in via Skype, if your internet connection is back, let's try that. But from now, I think we're going to have you either chat in or we'll follow up afterwards. So Anne.
Yep, I want to go on to this so that we can get to totally open questions here in a second. The next outcome we looked at was our success in engaging organizations, institutions, and elected officials. Interesting things happen with different forum cultures emerge. Now, I mean that in the broadest sense of the term, that did indeed reflect community dynamics as well as influential posters, including organizers and organizations. We found profoundly that there were complex and critical issues. Steve and Julia have talked about some of those. Very much drove forum engagement, and the term we used was the organizing power of local issues. These are explicitly local. If you want to talk about federal or state or even citywide issues, you must tie it to something that's related to your neighborhood, that's part of the rules of each of these forums. There are also forums that are citywide and statewide and national that we host, and so if people really want to talk about those, we encourage them to go on those forums. But when you keep it local, you get an amazing amount of dynamism. And when organizers and organizations and institutions and elected officials engage, you add a dimensionality to it that isn't better or worse. It just adds another perspective that I think is important. We found a real challenge with engaging local officials, local elected officials consistently, meaning, you know, they'd pop in occasionally and then not follow along. But, of course, because you don't know whether someone is, we call it lurking, where you just read your emails or you read it on the web or you read it in digest form, but you don't post. With elected officials, you don't know if they're actually monitoring the forum unless they post. We had some challenges with getting people at different levels of government. We've had no luck at all with state elected officials, local representatives. We've had some pretty good luck on these two forums with some very local city council, but much more so in one forum than the other. We have some school board members posting on both, but again, not very broadly, not very consistently. We also had the challenge that most city council members, if they got involved, just made announcements or did notices, which one of the things you'll see in the evaluation that we measured was depth, and we don't mean this in a pejorative sense, but when people talk about complex and challenging or exciting or interesting issues, that's a level of engagement that's different from a meeting notice or a piece of news that requires the former requires a much more personal level of engagement and involvement. And I think there's some fear about, if I engage in this forum as an elected official, I'm actually going to have to respond, which, as an elected official, I say, well, that is your job. But a lot of people are uncomfortable doing that. Last outcome.
So one thing I want to add to that is that we've actually, we've had in Frogtown since the evaluation, we've had Rena Moran, who's a state representative, post a handful of times. She's an African-American, first female African-American state rep in Minnesota's history. She, Frogtown is roughly a third Southeast Asian, sort of like 25% African American, 20% white. I don't have the numbers in front of me, but just recently she had an example where she actually posted something, actually that she had thought Mitt Romney had said, and asked the question, can I say this here? And it was about his attitudes and his approach to African Americans, and ended up being, a false. It was basically a spoof site, and she said, "Gosh, I'm sorry that it got me this way," but she used it in a way to sort of reach out to people locally in her district, and obviously we're interested in seeing more of that. And we have another forum, Longfellow, in particular, where we do have a state rep who does engage via the local neighbors forums. And we want to try to get other state representatives to sort of engage across the two or three or four neighbors forums that would be within one legislative district. But that's a harder slog, particularly you want to keep it local and not just, turning a neighborhood forum into a debate chamber on state issues, which is sort of against the local scope of our forums.
All right, so let me whiz through this last one. This is forum leadership and management. I don't think I'm going to spend a lot of time on this. You all can read it. We've talked a number of times about our forum managers, what they do. There's more information in the evaluation. The rules around two posts a day, and we have civility rules that are quite strict and adhered to tremendously well. People just behave on these forums, which is great, because that's part about trust, and it's about relationships, it's about sustainability, and be able to focus on what's happening in the neighborhood. What we do see on these forums, as well as all kinds of other forums, is that when there are a lot of people involved, just like in a neighborhood, helping keep the forum healthy and prosperous, a lot of people posting issues of significance to the neighbors, and a lot of people sort of helping each other out, again, just like a neighborhood, a physical neighborhood, they work very, very well. But they take a while to get there. So the last piece I'm going to let Steve take, and then we'll go to final questions about outcomes. Go ahead, Steve.
And questions and discussion and all, yes.
Yep,
so, I can just say that in my 17 years of sort of being in the front lines of sort of citizen-based democracy online, this has been some of the most rewarding work and some of the most important work that I've been involved with. And it's been part of an evolution and part of, sort of challenge ourselves to say, what can we do next that actually takes it further and makes a difference when, you know, we're not going to be Facebook, we're not going to spread like wildfire, it's not suddenly going to be Wikipedia for, you know, citizen engagement online. It really is, you know, like, how can we build lessons and share them and influence people indirectly, as well as serve the communities that we're, at least where we're based and where our volunteers are based, the most strongest way possible. So the key thing is that as an organization, we really shifted from the citywide online town hall, which is sort of almost exclusively a political chamber, which in my view attracts the max is about 1% of households, to a hybrid model where we basically embrace the neighborhood mailing list, if you will. And there's a lot of companies now in this space in the last year that have emerged as well. But basically, you have a hybrid of Angie's List, which is, you know, business recommendations, Craigslist in terms of giving things away for free and announcements. You have the issues forum, which is, you know, civic dialogue, and the free cycle where people are giving away things for free as well. And so you have these elements that where if you're local enough, you know, you're able to have a very vibrant exchange on all sorts of things. And some of our forums now are getting close to 25% of households. We have about 3 forums that are getting to that level. I have 1,000 people in my neighborhood in Stanish Erickson, for example, where I've been, you know, we've been building this up. And we still obviously maintain our citywide forum, and it's sort of a place where we push up the more political citywide discussions and then allows actually the civility to be even more cemented locally. So fast forward, we did all this work for 5 years. Basically, we were working on a relationship with the Knight Foundation. This was not a surprise. We've been working on it really hard over the years to sort of say, hey, in St. Paul, being a Knight community, can we go deeper with this model? Can we show that inclusion matters, that it isn't about creating virtual gated communities, you know, private spaces for nearest neighbors that only tend to serve places with high social capital where you can organize people quickly or where advertisers, you know, maybe a market to basically cleave off or redline in some sense, you know, the wealthiest areas and serve them and then make the most revenue possible and sort of leave behind the areas that won't generate revenue. We really said, hey, let's show that we can do this for everyone. Let's show that we can do it with openness, it's public, and bridge building. And so we managed to secure, as I mentioned at the beginning, a 3-year, $625,000 grant to basically go from 3,000 roughly participants in St. Paul to 10,000 to deeply focus the outreach resources, including the 11 people that we're training next week that we've hired 15 hours a week roughly for 15 weeks, speaking about 15 different languages, to get out into the community to recruit up to 10,000 people by the time we're done here, or more. We'll see what happens. And to focus that really on the 5 to 7 most sort of lower-income, ethnically diverse district councils. St. Paul's broken into 17 district councils. Some of them are actually quite large for a neighborhood sense, but some of them are smaller. Notably, the smaller ones tend to be the wealthier areas, going back to, you know, the ones that were, I guess, the squeaky wheels in the 70s about not wanting to be wanting to have more of a tight focus. So if you go to beneighbors.org, you can see the public entry point that we're going to eventually turn into a directory of neighbor connecting. Strategically, we link to other people's sites. Ideally, there would be a site in this nation or in this world, for that matter, where you could see a map and find out about your private electronic block clubs and your public neighbors forums and your blogs and other things. No matter what site you're hosted on, we want to try to encourage that. And then for the project info, you can go to that inclusion page there. And then one of the key places that we're doing with, you know, we're trying to say that it's like share information for free, but also potentially sell training, if you will, or do more hands-on work. A community foundation might bring us in. But our starting point this year is to get as many people to join the free Locals Online Exchange for people who do neighborhood work online, connecting no matter what kind of neighborhood you're in, and then to basically introduce some of our inclusion exchanges in there. There are about 300 people on there because we started this during the Ford work. There's also the Digital Inclusion Network with like 400 some odd people, which is more global, and that's also where we're sort of introducing the idea of community voices. So a lot of digital inclusion folks are more obviously oriented towards skills and broadband and access, and we want to say, hey, now as we build this forward, the next divide is, can my community have a voice, right? And can I, you know, gain access to, you know, setting the agenda in my community via these tools? So that's a quick overview of sort of what's happening next, and your input on this evaluation is going to help us with our future evaluation. And you know, so that's one of the reasons why we really wanted to gather folks together. I did see Marcos added a question about how is BeNeighbors different than the portal into eDemocracy. So eventually we see BeNeighbors.org as potentially, you know, we're sort of testing the waters, a standalone website that is a directory, sort of like a Got Milk campaign for neighbor connecting online. One of the problems, honestly, is there's a bunch of .com venture capital now out here and with very different models, very proprietary, helping the cause, if you will, but they don't exactly want to collaborate, much less help other .coms find people. The reality is that Facebook groups is where most of the momentum is right now in terms of people somewhere just starting a group, right, and they're doing it for their block. A lot of the group online connecting is still the CC list from a sheet of paper passed around at a barbecue. These are what I call electronic block clubs, if you will. But the more public side, there's probably, you know, 20,000 neighborhood email lists across the United States, and there's no directory. And so strategically, the idea is that if we can show our 30 neighborhood forums, as well as the other 15 or so that exist here hosted by a neighborhood group, on a Facebook group, whatever, that sort of are large enough scale and public enough or willing to be listed but private, that's the idea there. And it does cause a little confusion, but we've decided that it's worth it. There we go. So, Anne, back to go into dialogue and questions.
Let's do that. Sandy asked about can anybody start a forum? Yes, you have to get 100 people to sign up to open most forums. Sometimes we do a little bit more to make sure they're a little bit more stable when they launch. And that's been the case for a very, very long time. I think what's important to note here is that this is part of our mission and vision as an organization, why we've sought the funding we have, which is to move beyond the self-starting, which is where you've got a lot of capacity and a lot of motivation, into communities where this is not common and it's not easy for them. But to create an opportunity in those communities to add this to the existing in-person networks that happen in any community. Go ahead, let's open it.
All right, so feel free to talk up. If you're on mute, you can take yourself off of mute. You can also feel free to put the question in the type. But let's just, and I would love any comments you have, general or specific. So who, just step right up.
This is Corinne with eDemocracy. I'm the outreach coordinator for eDemocracy. I just wanted to make a comment. We are working on this content engagement aspect as I see it. When I read the Ford evaluation work from the past, and we did do some work last summer in Minneapolis and St. Paul, and now we have a great opportunity with a lot more resources to kind of go full throttle for the summer and beyond. I'm trying to crowdsource information about inclusive outreach best practices and kind of inclusive content engagement best practices. So if you have anything related to that, we're doing a lot of work around that with our amazing staff that we're bringing on. I haven't counted how many languages we have yet of this staff of 11 people. I think it's about 8 languages. So I'm going to put my email in this list. So please message me.
Actually, you know, Corinne, as long as you're mentioning it, if you could just give a short outline on about, you know, you just introduce like 2 or 3 of the staff people, because someone asked a question about, you know, how did we make our choices for hiring? And I put a few text notes in there about
carefully.
That, but you know, why don't you just take a minute, about what you did, what you've been doing, and then a few of the hires are gonna be.
Well, Anne, Carol, and I worked really hard on and some other staff members on job descriptions, and we were really looking for people that didn't necessarily they could have that tech background if that's fine, but we really wanted to find people who had a lot of compassion and passion around building the power of their community's voice in the Twin Cities. A lot of the people that I interviewed really, really talked about this issue of people around them not feeling like they had a voice and them they themselves having a hard time encouraging community members to utilize their voice because it was so ingrained in them that they had no power in their community to change the way that their lives were going, that this was kind of all set up and institutionalized so much that there was no way that they had power. So they were really, really excited about this opportunity to pull together people from the community and try our best to raise up community voices by bringing on legislators, by bringing on the police, by bringing on the Parks Department, by bringing on all these people and then asking the right questions and adding the right articles to the forums, and then also moderating them in such a way, you know, with having two post limits, that there is enough space for their voice to be heard as well. And so I think that it's going to be quite a process, and we're going to learn a lot about all of this. Our staff members are amazing. There's a lot of people with a variety of backgrounds. So, yeah, Steve?
I would just say watch our blog because as we start our training next week, and you know, we're going to try to over time tell the story about this group, and you know, we really think it's just one of the things is, you know, if you don't ask somebody, why would they join, right? And so getting people into the position to be able to ask them in person, to be able to ask online, and a key lesson from last year when we had our training with our outreach group last year was trust, and that basically no one's going to trust us as an organization or a brand or whatever it might be. I mean, one of the Hmong women who was helping with our outreach said, well, when she's been introducing it to people, they heard the word E and they thought it was a pyramid scheme because there's been a lot of rip-offs, online-related pyramid schemes apparently in the Hmong community. And so we're like, wow. And what we realized was that our hires, is people are going to trust the people we hire far more than they're going to trust us. And basically, if we can't, as an organization, can't fail our staff, because they're basically giving up their reputation to work with us in some ways. And so that's when Corinne mentioned forum engagement work, is that we really have to make sure that it isn't just about numbers, right? It isn't just about getting people in the room. It's about making that a relevant experience and making sure that voices are raised. And this is sort of back to the future in that when we did the work with Bao and Julia with the forum engagement work in 2010, it was building on a couple of smaller grants that actually had already gotten people in the room, and we hired them to really focus on, well, now let's make this a more engaging and rich experience on the space. And so now with Knight, we're doing both numbers, but also, again, more revamped engagement work, where last year was actually more about taking numbers to scale, so going all across St. Paul, trying to start more forums, doing some work in other parts of Minneapolis. It wasn't as intensely around the dialogue side, and so now we're going to be doing a bit of both, and you're going to see sort of a cycling through. We may have a big summer burst of numbers, but then we're also going to have a fall of engagement, and that's going to be really interesting to see how that all transpires.
I also just wanted to add that since we have people from all over country, that a large number of our immigrant communities come from areas where they might have lived in refugee camps, or you know, their cultural community might have been persecuted to some degree, and so there's a lot of that kind of intrinsic fear that they bring when they come here, and you know, then they come into our own institutionalized system and have to figure all of that out. And how do we deal with that? How do we encourage people to talk? Trust is the key, like Steve was talking about. But I just wanted to give people a little glimpse of that background and that reality, and that not everybody in the Twin Cities is really aware of that reality. So building that respect across those communities, whether, I mean, and that could happen even in a neighborhood on one of the neighbors forums where, you know, there's a new community coming in who have these experiences, and the people that have lived there aren't fully aware of that broad range of experiences that community has that they're bringing in. So that's definitely a reality that we're trying to address and trying to create this atmosphere.
Yep, it's about cultural competency in the broadest sense of the term, and awareness and not assuming you know. There are several questions here about engaging elected officials. and trust, and having their constituents say, hey, we want to see you online, and so on. And, of course, if they're not there, they don't see those requests. One of the things we've talked about, because it's not just elected officials, it's also some institutions and organizations, for example, school districts or the city council as a body or the mayor's office and so on, where they're trying to figure out how to not have these be big echo chambers where a bunch of constituents deluge them in such a way that they feel they're expected to make these complex and detailed written responses, which is a very legitimate concern. It's just that these forums aren't like that, by and large. One of the things that we're thinking about doing that I'm really excited about is bringing small groups of people together, of institutional representatives or elected officials who have been participating successfully with those who have not, but are very, very good candidates to do this. They're a logical connection. It's in their neighborhood and so on. And just facilitating an exchange among them about how do you handle this and how do you handle that. I think that's going to be very successful. Now, they may still choose not to participate, and you can't make somebody do it, but I don't want them to feel they are concerned or afraid or just unsure about how to do it. We can at least eliminate those as barriers.
So other questions or comments that people might have, feel free to pipe in.
Yeah, question, Steve?
Yes.
Go ahead.
Question about what sounded like a proprietary civic-minded social media sites. I don't know, Steve, what you had in mind. It sounds like, C-Click Fix, and Every Block came up. But you indicated that those sites are proprietary, or at least some like them. Could you identify the ones that you'd like to be working with, but that for whatever reason are not making themselves available to your forums and to your work?
So it's a good question. So, you know, obviously, until I formally ask people across the industry, do you want to be part of a BeNeighbors.org directory? Could you make metadata available? Could we make this a big thing? You know, I don't have the funding for the full vision on that, so it's premature for me to say they actually wouldn't want to work together. Where that sort of evaluative comment it comes from is on the Locals Online forum. I find that basically folks that are involved in this commercially, while many of them have joined the Locals Online group, they're not so chatty, and partly because they're competing with each other. So we have, particularly in the last year, Nextdoor.com, with I believe about $10 million in venture capital, has entered the scene. It was money funged off of a sports fan site, and they have a good media people. And so we're now seeing people propose some of these groups actually on our own forums, like in Roseville, where we have a suburban forum, a citywide forum, an online town hall, if you will. There's a site called Neighborland, we've actually had some good communication with them recently. It's kind of like C-Click Fix, but instead of complaining about a pothole, you say, I'd like to see this in my neighborhood. So it's a little bit more progressive in the sense that it's saying, who all wants to make this change here? And then you can, like a petition, kind of comment on that. And so you have these different models. There's Hey Neighbor, which is smaller, but they're out there. If you go to e-democracy.org/locals, there's a link to a list of about 25 different folks in the space. In general, the biggest challenge is that I believe in diffusion. I believe that the technology, for the most part, is more of a commodity. And so the question is if you're going to start one of these in your neighborhood, we've always found that a leader is key, a forum manager, as we call them, or someone who starts it. And I think the question between public and private is a really important one, meaning is your space basically restricted to residents only? Is it designed for, like, I would say at about 1 to 200 households, you want to be private. You don't want to be in Google. But our forums are oriented toward 10,000 residents in an area. And the more public you make the larger ones, the better in my view, because then, you know, elected officials can follow them, that's not restricted, and the local businesses can follow them, and you can have a much more of an open, sort of accessible approach. The last thing I'll say is that no matter what happens, it's all about really what, you know, Facebook in some ways is in the pole position, and people are using Facebook groups more and more often organically. The problem with Facebook groups is you can't export them. Also, when you hit about 200 people or so, the settings change to only send you notifications from your friends when they post to the group. And so it's inherently friend-oriented, which means that it doesn't scale very well to when you get a larger group, like, you know, our system, which is like everybody gets everything. So it's much more of a two-way experience rather than encouraging some cliquish behavior that I've seen on some larger Facebook groups that have been tied to neighborhoods. And most folks don't even know those settings are out there, and it's really only in the last couple of weeks that I've noticed that trend. So those are some comments.
Follow-up question. So far, I've heard, just listening to you, I've heard one issue that came up, which was a big snowstorm. What are the other issues that your forums, that people are generating an interest in your forums?
So I'll rattle off three real quick, and this is more generally across our forums. Some big examples on the civic side. In addition to the plant swaps and the, hey, I have a free couch in the corner, or, you know, what school should I send my kids to? Does anyone recommend a babysitter?
Lost pets, that's a popular one.
Lost pets actually are one of the biggest growth factors on our forums. People lose a cat, and they're very motivated. They join the forum, and they tend not to leave. But some of the civic issues are issues related to airport noise in South Minneapolis, issues related to housing foreclosures in Dayton's Bluff and St. Paul. Someone actually posted in a chat here, don't forget lost chickens. That's right. We've had lots of good conversations about chickens, lost chickens, and puns related to lost chickens. We have issues related to policing. So typically it's sort of like, what were all the squad cars doing there, and what was that all about? And then some of the burglary discussions evolve into, you know, are police resourced enough? You know, are we doing enough with crime prevention versus, you know, the judicial system? It really runs the gamut.
And new businesses? And has anybody tried the new this or that? What do you think about their pizza? And all very positive. Just some really, it's like Urban Spoon in a much less concentrated fashion.
Mm-hmm. Thank you.
Yep.
Somebody was also talking here about the digital divide and what were our intents, our intentions with regard to this. If you go back to the objectives at the beginning of the presentation, the notion of explicitly bridging the digital divide was not the intent of this effort, because this was about people who one way or another had internet access and wanted to add to their personal face-to-face relationships with neighbors an online dimension. While we did provide supportive classes and things to help some people become more comfortable, that was not the primary focus of this effort. People who had access to help them be more comfortable in using that space in a more neighborly way.
Let me add something to this. When we launched in 1994, when about 4% of Minnesotans were online, we were asked this question a lot, right? You know, some questions say, how dare you try to create a place people can have influence on politics because not everybody's online? And we've heard that actually every year. And I think that the key thing for us is that it's important to create the spaces now so that people expect that the internet is used to have a voice in their community, to connect with their mayor, to connect with their neighborhood, to bridge divides between in communities, or to help, you know, cultural groups who live near each other be neighbors, right? And so I really think that it's really important to do that. And we've actually we're sort of in a sandwich position where in the old days, well, even last year, a lot of neighborhood groups that we're working with, we would have those that would be very proactive on the forums and would use those like a Facebook page of their own, right? And it was a community information stream. They didn't control it, but they could reach the most people the most effectively in the neighborhood because they joined the stream. And we've had those folks. And then we have still some neighborhoods that will say, we don't even use cell phones, you know, we're with the people, and face-to-face is where it's at, and, you know, and again, how dare you, or how do you think? And I tell you, when you table at events, right, you get people who will walk by, and this one woman once, you know, put her hands on her hips, and she's like, I am abhorred that you would do this, right? And we've had folks that, you know, that are in positions of civic leadership that we would rather have them say, you know, hey, let's reach people anywhere we can, any way we can, and create the expectation that the net can, you know, help build bridges among people. Because I sort of feel like the democratic divide or the civic divide is actually much far wider now than the digital divide. The last thing I'll say, though, about that is we have now been leapfrogged by some neighborhood staff in some new neighborhoods where they're saying, well, we created a Facebook page, we're now using Twitter, and you want to add another channel? You know, I mean, or they're even creating their own Facebook groups, which are basically like mailing lists and trying to sort out, like how that, how, why would they join a network or why would they be part of a group? And we've actually, though, had groups that have had Facebook groups created by their neighborhood association who have actually asked us now to come in because we're a neutral host and we are more sophisticated at dealing with controversy, and then they don't have to be put in the position to be a censor when things go wrong, although often it's more that they don't want to, they're not put in the position to disappoint someone who asked them to be a censor rather than censoring themselves. So it's a kind of a interesting situation, but it continues to evolve. And I think the key thing for us is that there's value in being a network, and there's a value in just aggressively saying we're going to build it now because it matters more that they have a space than that we, you know, wait, I guess, if you will.
And that we're very clear, we're not trying to supplant. Right, we're not trying to take over. We're not trying to say face-to-face isn't important. And in fact, many, many forums, as they mature, create opportunities for forum members to get together in person as a supplement. And so if you've got a Facebook thing and that's working great, awesome. If you've got a Yahoo group, that's great. If you do a lot of community gatherings, it's awesome. That's, we're happy to be part of that effort. So it's not us or, it's us too, for the people who are interested.
This is Leticia, you know, and I asked a question about digital divide, and I only asked it on the chat because I wasn't sure. I felt like we were running out of time, which I know that we are at. But I just wanted to clarify, the question was mostly based off of my experiences working in New Mexico for a community-based organization doing internet advocacy work there and trying to get people connected to broadband internet. And I'm just curious about how the project understands digital inclusion, which might be explained in the full report, because there seems to be, of course, you were working particularly with very disenfranchised groups there in the Twin Cities. And so I was just curious, it seems like the next question would be issues of barriers, whether it's financial or, you know, physical barriers, getting transportation to go to community centers to get broadband access to be able to participate in these online forums. So that's the question. But I definitely understand the kind of technophobia that you come up against in doing this kind of work, but that wasn't what I was trying to get at.
Could I answer based on what we're planning on doing currently?
Please, Corinne, go ahead.
Okay. So we do recognize that there's a lot of digital inclusion barriers. We kind of see ourselves in that, in a spectrum or a pyramid, and kind of like that last piece where people actually get the skills, they get the hardware, they get the connection, and then they actually get to a place where they're digitally literate enough that they can start to empower themselves using these tools, which is somewhat of a new space compared to older spaces that it's harder to break down those barriers, other physical spaces. So what we're doing now, you know, that's not our necessary part of digital inclusion, but we are going, when we go out there and we do the old school organizing techniques for tabling or door knocking, we plan to, there's a lot of other people who do that kind of work. So we want to get people information about where the computer labs are. We want to get them to connect it to organizations that give out free computers in the area. Comcast is an internet provider in the area that is now doing low-cost broadband. As far as I understand it, the federal government is kind of forcing them to do it, but it's $10 a month, which is still costly for some, but it does give a lot of people more access. So we're trying to, when we go to people's houses and we see them at events, we want to say, if they say to us, I don't have a computer, oh, well, this is where you can get a computer. It's right over here. It's just down the street, yada, yada, that kind of stuff. That's how we're kind of addressing that. But we have a lot of community organizations that we work with that say, oh, the community I work with doesn't have access. Well, now you're just kind of blocking out your entire group that you're working with when there could be 1 to 10 to 20, 20-year-olds to 30-year-olds that do have access, that do have the skills. And we need to realize that that is changing every day, every year. That's changing. More and more people are coming in and getting access through being in high school, being in college, for the people that are able to do that. And that's not everybody, but we don't want to, you know, disqualify those people because you know, we think that they don't have access. And there are quite a few people who are getting access through smartphones. So we kind of want to look at all those aspects and put them into our efforts. Hopefully that answers the questions.
I have something to add to that, but Ed also wants to say something. Go ahead, Ed.
I might say what you're going to say. The other thing about our system is that it's inherently designed for low bandwidth. It's designed to handle email, and it strips all of these postings and messages that people have of all of their attachments and makes them into a link. So when people they could be logged on a 56K connection and not need any broadband whatsoever. They could have, as Corinne was mentioning, cell phone and have a very limited data plan and still be able to see these messages, the text of these messages, and know that there's a larger text file or a PDF or a video file. But they don't. The emails themselves don't bring that down. So it's a very low bandwidth and by design, the whole system.
So something to add to that, one of the new innovations this year is, well, it's an innovation, but one of the things with having a three-year window, we're really excited about that. And so we've actually created a formal partnership agreement, and the city of St. Paul has signed on. They're very interested in, you know, we're negotiating sort of like what kind of links will go on their homepage and how will we be promoted via their email list, but creating a formal relationship because they're very interested. They basically have acknowledged, reaching out to raise the diverse voices across this city rather than just those who always show up, well, we're with that. We're with you on that, and we need to work together, and we'll be part of that. And as a follow-up, we've met with the parks, which some of them do have computer labs. We're going to meet with the libraries, to sort of, which is part of the city as well, but to, you know, really try to formalize a relationship. And one simple idea is actually having a box for sign-up sheets, you know, to sign up for the form on paper, or little tent cards can sit next to things at these access centers. And by formalizing a partnership, we can get into some of those spaces. We're also a partner with SPNN, which is the cable access center in St. Paul, but they're also the fiscal agent for the AmeriCorps Community Technology Empowerment Project, which puts AmeriCorps folks in like 20 to 30 different tech centers, you know, community tech centers all around Minneapolis and St. Paul. And so that relationship building, I think, is going to be key, and to sort of formalize it a bit more rather than just sort of saying, oh, yeah, you know, it'd be great if you could spread the word. The last thing I'll mention is that there's a big trend now in philanthropy circles where those that are sort of in the online donation advocacy space are using phrases like mobile-friendly email. Well, we were leapfrogged in some ways, right? So we basically, because we were text-only and our simplicity, you know, and our resources at a time when everyone was moving to HTML email and rich this and rich that, because we sort of stuck with, like, lowest common denominator, we are incredibly mobile-friendly. So basically, you know, if you can push reply and you signed up and all you have is essentially mobile email, in terms of your regular net access on a Virgin mobile phone on Android, because that's your main net access, you know, that you can viably participate. And so I guess you could call us lucky in a sense that we were leapfrogged by others and stuck to our guns around accessibility. So I think we've gone over time now, and so I know folks might be popping off. We would love feedback on this event. Feel free to leave a final chat message about what you thought about it, what value you have, and we are going to we've recorded this, and we're going to make it available. So definitely spread the word about that. I guess it'd be nice to say, is there one last question or comment that someone would like to share before we conclude today's event? Now is your chance.
Hello?
All right, Anne. Go ahead, please.
Can I be heard now?
Yes, you're good, Julia. Go for it.
Okay. I just wanted to add one more thing about experiences with digital inclusion. One of the things that I think is very important when doing this work, you know, first we recognize that there's a lot of people who don't have internet in their homes. But recognizing those people who do and what influence they have in the community is very important. Because I would see spillovers of discussions that we had on the forum. I would see this happening when I went to the Brand Call Center or to a coffee shop. You'd hear people who did not have access either to e-democracy or even to email, any sort of internet access. They would be talking about those things. So I think that's something that I found was pretty useful, identifying who are those people who disseminate information to the community, whether they're young people or community leaders or advocates or, you know, something like that. So, and I just wanted to add that on the digital inclusion piece.
All right. Well, Anne, I'll give you the final word of anything you'd like to conclude with.
All I want to say is thank you so much, all of you, for helping us learn more and giving us a chance to share our findings. As Steve said, please weigh in on the evaluation, on this webinar, and any questions we can answer, we'll be happy to do so. Thank you all so much for participating.
Thank you, everyone. Oh, and I should, last thing I'll mention is that in the fall we are planning some future webinars, one, it would be one or two, but on neighbor connecting generally and on inclusive social media, more of a training sort of introductory approach. And we are evaluating whether or not to put together an online course. There may be a fee associated with this. Part of our grant is to help other Knight communities adapt our lessons, and so they're sort of prepaid, but the idea is to have an experience next winter in 2013, a mix of online and a series of webinars, get really into the nitty-gritty of how-to. So we're exploring that option, and so if you know either whether you'd be interested or know whether a funder is interested in funding you to be part of it, or, you know, as an individual wanted to participate, you know, we are trying to sort of assess the market demand for that. You know, one of our goals in the long run is obviously not just to serve St. Paul or Minneapolis, but to really figure out how to spread this knowledge and to really make, you know, online connecting in a civic way, in a neighborhood way, in a city way, far more inclusive anywhere in the world where folks are trying to make that happen, and we'd love to help you. All right. Thanks so much, everyone.